The headlines: a massive crowd of Palestinians pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in a show of unity against Israel ahead of the International Arts Day. Insecurity dominating the U.S. housing market, with a new report suggesting massive public frustration with soaring home prices. Also, Ukraine's defense minister warns of extremely difficult weeks ahead amid Russia's looming offensive in the east. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. It's our top story for this half hour. We begin with the developments in Palestine, where just a day ahead of the International Arts Day, tens of thousands of Palestinians have converged on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound for a congregational prayer. Palestinian media have put the number of participants at 250,000, who gathered in a show of unity amid the recent Israeli desecrations of the holy site. Following the prayers, the worshippers chanted slogans against Israel and condemned the regime for its violent crackdowns at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The gathering was held despite Israeli warnings. Joining us now for special coverage of events in Palestine, we're joined by journalist and activist Issam Adwan, who's joining us from Rafah City. Also, we have Palestinian writer and political analyst Jafar Amini, who's with us from Perth. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Adwan in Rafah City. As the Israeli atrocities increase, Palestinians, as we're seeing, tend to become more and more united. As we saw, 250,000 attended the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound last night and chanted slogans against Israel despite these restrictions. Help us better understand the situation.
Okay, going over the past 20 years of what is going on in Jerusalem, we can observe that the Israeli administration have been enforcing a new status quo that the Israeli Jewish settlers are sharing one of the holiest and one of the most sacred sites for Muslims and Arabs as well. The number of the participants yesterday in the congregational prayer, I believe if we removed some of the limitations, we would see several millions of Palestinians gathering at the Al-Aqsa compound and praying together and acting, you know, in scenes of resistance to the Israeli policies that we have been observing over the past years. Those limitations of the Palestinians strip the majority of people of my age. They have been denied their entire lives to visit the Jerusalem.
All right, Jafar Amini in Perth. We've been seeing this trend over the past years, a continuous trend where Israeli forces storm Al-Aqsa during Ramadan to try and prevent gatherings of Palestinian worshippers. Why is that? What are the motives behind this, in your opinion?
The motive is very simple. They want to provoke a reaction from the Palestinians in Jerusalem, and in sort of vain hope that they can get rid of us. And you can rely on the Palestinians, especially in Jerusalem, to stay fast and to defend Al-Aqsa Mosque for the last drop. I just want to make a couple of comments, if I may, on what you said about unity and what your guest from Rafah said. Unfortunately, I did not hear much of what he said because he faded away. But you said about unity. Yes, there has always been and will always be unity amongst the Palestinian ranks, Muslims and Christians alike. The disunity is with the leadership, both in Gaza and in Ramallah. They are both letting down the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause. It's no good us using rhetoric and slogans to win a war. This is a war for our very existence. The Israeli government, since 1948, every Israeli government, their goal and their ultimate aim is to occupy all of historical Palestine without any Palestinians in it. Jerusalem has been getting the brunt of their brutality exactly or in a way that the Gazans have been suffocated within the last breath of their lives. Palestine, Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Haram al-Sharif should not only be defended by the civilian Palestinians. It's a Muslim duty. This is Ramadan, Laylatul Qadr. And if anybody, any person, anywhere in the world, out of the 1.7 billion Muslims, the Muslim Ummah, call himself or herself a Muslim, they should come to the rescue of Jerusalem and their brothers and sisters in Palestine. At the contrary, what is happening? Arab leaders, especially those despots in the Gulf states, are conspiring against Palestine and normalizing with Israel as if Israel is not raping their sisters, is not desecrating their holy shrines, and is not stealing their land, because Palestine is an Arab land, and the Arabs have abandoned it.
Issam Adwan, what is your assessment of the international reaction, or lack of it, to the Israeli violations that are taking place? The likes of the United Nations, the EU, the Arab League, their silence and inaction has effectively led to the continuation of this this status quo. Don't you agree?
True. As I said, if we've done a smaller project observing what is going on in Jerusalem and what's going on in Palestine, not only in Jerusalem for the past 20 years or over the 70 years of this occupation, we can observe that this the continuation of this Palestinian genocide and uprooting of the Palestinian identity, and specifically what's happening in Jerusalem is an uprooting of the Islamic identity throughout allowing the Israeli Jewish settlers going into Jerusalem and imposing a new status quo, as it happened to the Al-Ibrahimi Mosque. Such failure to respond by the international community is not something that the Palestinians have not been used to. Gaza has been suffocating and, you know, faced four brutal wars, 2008, 2012, 2014, and 2021, yet the international community failed to react and to abide by the human rights norms that they have announced and the democracy they have been claiming. Such failure by the international community, as well as the second guest stated, that such failure of the Palestinian leadership as well as the Arab leaders to abide by, at least to feel the Islamic, you know, the Islamic feelings and to defend their holy mosque. Such failure have led the Palestinians to continue the resistance, and the unity of the people is the only thing that we have to resist the occupation and to defend the holy mosque.
Jafar Amini in Perth, some interesting reactions there. One focused on the important day that's to come, that's tomorrow, International Quds Day. What impact can a day like this, Quds Day, and the rallies in solidarity with Palestinians have on, first of all, the determination of Palestinians to pursue their cause, and also about global awareness with regards to the plight of the Palestinians?
Well, that's it. The last word is awareness. We need people to be aware of what's happening and what's been happening for the last 75 years in Palestine, because there is restrictions all over the Western world about news, positive news about Palestinians. If Hamas sends one of those rockets over Israel that falls on empty ground and hurts nobody, there's a chorus in every news station in the Western world about terrorism and how we are terrorists. Yet when they see the Israeli thugs march into Al-Aqsa Mosque fully armed and tie worshippers to the floor and kick them and throw stunt guns and gas canisters, nobody says a word. Israel is defending itself from those terrorists. The main message here, my friend, Al-Quds Day should not be just one day of the year. Though we are thankful for Iran and for the late Ayatollah Khomeini for establishing such an important day. Palestine, for any decent, honest, honorable Muslim or Arab, should be an everyday issue, an everyday duty, because when they rape Al-Aqsa, And as our friend in Rafah said, Al-Ibrahimi Mosque in Hebron, they're raping us all if we are true Muslims, not just a word. And very important that we spread the message and tell the truth as it is. There is plenty of evidence to show the world that these brutes, the occupiers of Palestine, have a different agenda altogether. They are not looking for peace or security. They are looking for more conquest, more land theft, and more punishments of the Palestinians.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Issam Adwan, journalist and activist, joining us from Rafah City, and Palestinian writer and political analyst Jafar Amini speaking to us from Perth. Thank you for contributing to this segment of the program. Moving on, most home buyers in the United States are frustrated with soaring prices in the housing sector, which make it almost impossible for many Americans to own property. Official data show home prices rose nearly 19% in 2021. The figures also indicate that the median existing home price for all housing types in March 2022 was $375,000, up 15% from the same month last year. The problem has been compounded by a surge in borrowing rates. The interest charged on a 30-year fixed-rate loan has risen to over 5%, the highest level since 2010, compared to an average of almost 3% last year. Housing supplies were already tight when sales took off during the coronavirus pandemic, but builders have failed to keep up with a shortage of workers and global supply chain problems, which have pushed housing prices even higher. We talked to Jack Rasmus, professor of political economy at St. Mary's College of California. He believes the existing U.S. housing crisis will deteriorate.
The U.S. has not been building enough home units, housing units, for median and below people, mostly just high-end, mostly new housing. And the demand, of course, when you have such a short supply, it drives up the price even more. So it's a supply problem. It's also a demand problem. It's also the Federal Reserve's interest rates problem. And we already see in the last month or so a significant decline in new housing construction and purchases. And this is going to only get worse here going forward very, very shortly. It's already deteriorating. So inflation in housing is going to remain with us for some time and get worse. And the problem is the more that housing prices go up, the more that rents go up. That has an effect of dragging up rents, and far more people are renting. About 50 million people are renters in this country, or rental units, 50 million rental units, maybe 100 million people. So they are being squeezed even more, I would say, than new home buyers.
Ukraine's defense minister warns that Russia's developing offensive in the east will lead to, quote, destruction and painful casualties. Alexei Reznikov says Russia has already gathered its forces for a large-scale offensive in eastern Ukraine. The minister says his country faces, quote, extremely difficult 2 weeks as Russia's new offensive looms. Moscow has shifted its focus to the east and south of Ukraine as the war between the two neighbors enters its third month. Russia has captured several villages in eastern Ukraine as it seeks to take full control of the Donbass region. And tensions between Moscow and the West over Ukraine show no sign of abating. The Russian president has now vowed to give a swift response to countries attempting to interfere in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin said Russia had already taken decisions on how to react in such situations. He accused the West of pushing Ukraine into conflict with Russia. Putin underlined that Western countries wanted to cut Russia into pieces. The Russian president made the comments while addressing lawmakers in St. Petersburg. Political commentator Mike Billington says Russia is trying to send a message that it's ready to use nuclear weapons if its existence is threatened.
But there's no question that the Russian policy is that if they see a situation which is attempting to behead their government, if there is a first strike, for instance, and as you probably know, there are two U.S. senators who have openly called for keeping a nuclear attack on Russia on the table. This is madness, insanity. And yet this is their preparation. And what is the Russian response? If their country is being threatened, its existence being threatened, they are willing to use nuclear weapons. Are they going to have a first strike nuclear weapon? Of course not. But they, well, a first strike in the sense of they will use their nuclear weapons even in a conventional attack, which is threatening to destroy their country. And of course, Mr. Putin and the rest of the Russian population know very well the last time they saw this mass mobilization of forces on their border, they saw Barbarossa come in and kill 27 million citizens of the Soviet armies and the Soviet citizenry. They are not going to allow another World War II. They could see World War II building, or World War III building in the Ukraine when the Western-backed Ukrainian forces were preparing to have a blitzkrieg against the Donbas republics just a few days before they made the decision that they, on February 24th, to move in.
Russia could not be any clearer. Keep arming Ukraine and risk World War III. This is in response to the continued arming of Ukraine by the West. Russia's warning, however, is falling on deaf ears since the U.S. and its allies are adamant on providing Ukraine with more lethal weapons. Russia's other threat is also being ignored, the risk of a nuclear war. Well, the U.S. is leading the group of countries delivering arms to Ukraine, with Germany now becoming more aggressive in providing those weapons. After a U.S.-sponsored meeting that was attended by 40 countries in Germany, the Pentagon chief appropriately stated, "We will move heaven and earth to defend Ukraine." The U.S. has also said it wanted to see Russia weaken militarily and unable to recover quickly. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Imam Khomeini said, "The racist Zionist regime has always been a source of discord among regional states."
The city of Al-Quds, the jewel of the Islamic world. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. On the threshold of the World Quds Day, the Zionist regime has escalated its crimes against Palestinian nation on the one hand and is making efforts to further normalize ties with gullible Arab regimes. All these measures are aimed at casting the cause of Palestine into oblivion. This has been the Israeli policy for the past decades. The fake regime claims to make peace and come to reconciliation with Palestine and Arab governments while it continues aggression and brutal suppression of innocent civilians. It seems it is only the Zionist regime which can practice such a deceptive policy. This much of brazenness has its roots in the all-out support of the U.S. and European governments who shamelessly claim to defend human rights, democracy, and freedom. As a matter of fact, the Western regimes have been the vassals and stooges of Israel for several decades, to the extent that no party or person can take power in these countries, especially the U.S., unless they fully pursue the Israeli interests. Oh, The victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979 was an earthquake, and it changed the situation of Zionists in the occupied territories. A new factor entered the equations of West Asia, namely formation of the axis of resistance against the axis of compromise and servility. The victory of the Islamic Revolution as the greatest event of the 20th century helped shape the first units of resistance in Palestine. The group was called Palestine Islamic Jihad Movement, which was shaped by martyr Fatih Shaghaghi. Shaghaghi writes in his book that Imam Khomeini's revolution is the only way to encounter Israel. He makes it clear that the movement had been formed in Palestine under the impact of Imam Khomeini's uprising. Palestine Islamic Jihad Movement drew the attention of most Islamic currents, and they supported it. 8 years later, the first Intifada was born out of the Islamic resistance groups. The Intifada was called the Intifada of a Stone. Simultaneously, the second Islamic resistance movement was shaped, comprising young members living in Palestine. The Intifada, which had started in 1987, continued for 6 years. This forced Zionists to propose negotiation with Palestine Liberation Organization and the credulous head of the organization, Yasser Arafat. However, the efforts of Israel for talks with Palestinians go back to one decade before, after the Al-Karama battle in Jordan and coming to power of armed Palestinian groups and the incident at Munich Olympics in 1972, Zionists tried to create relations with Palestinians. The channels of relations were created by leftist currents in Israel and some Palestinians who were advocates of the West as they lived in Europe. Zionists in 1982, in order to put Palestinian liberating groups in bottleneck, occupied Beirut and expelled Palestinians from there. Although Zionists continued to occupy South Lebanon for almost 2 decades, it set the ground for negotiations with Palestinians. The Intifada of a Stone in 1987 dictated the logic to Israel that they should expect more clashes if they didn't move toward talks. On November 15, 1988, Arafat announced the independence of Palestine. The move appeared to be revolutionary and brave, yet it was indeed a blatant retreat from armed struggles that had started 3 decades earlier. The declaration was announced less than 1 year after the first Intifada. The Palestinian people had lost many martyrs during the period, and Zionists were under serious pressure. The treacherous Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak told Arafat that he was dealing with his blood as he strongly supported the previously signed Camp David Pact. The Madrid conference was held in October 1991 with the support of the US and then USSR. The conference was held with the aim of reviewing and, if possible, exterminating the Intifada, which was in the fourth year of existence. The Madrid conference was among the first global efforts towards the so-called Middle East peace process. The fabricated Zionist regime, PLO, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan were present at the conference. This conference was the last conference which was held with the simultaneous aegis of Washington and Moscow as the Soviet Union collapsed in the same year. The Madrid conference ended after 3 days with no tangible fruit. Within 2 years that the supplementary sessions of the conference were held in Washington, no result was attained either. However, while the conference was underway in Madrid, a Palestinian team headed by Abu Mazen was clandestinely negotiating with Zionists in Oslo, Norway. The Oslo talks were intensively kept hush-hush by Europeans till they ended. PLO failed to materialize its demands, and finally, under the European pressure, the organization capitulated to a weak agreement as the precursor of complementary agreements. The Oslo Agreement had no fruit, but recognition of the fabricated illegitimate regime Israel by PLO. On the other side, Zionists didn't recognize Palestine as a country, but they just recognized PLO as the official representative of the Palestinians inhabiting on the West Bank of River Jordan. According to the agreement signed in 1993 by Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat in Washington, Zionists agreed to give parts of Palestine to PLO. According to the agreement in 1994, it was decided to give the Gaza Strip and a tiny part of Jericho to PLO. It was also agreed that the region was temporarily given to Arafat, and during the negotiations, which should not take more than 5 years, the final agreement was supposed to be concluded by the two sides.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Day of Al-Quds is just around the corner, yet the Israeli aggression against Palestinians continues. Israel's killed another Palestinian in the Jenin refugee camp, adding to the number of deaths and injuries over the past several weeks, which has seen an uptick in Israeli violence against Palestinians, especially in Al-Quds. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether this Al-Quds Day will mobilize Palestinian supporters en masse and around the world to highlight the suffering of Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli regime. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mick Napier joins us. He's an activist and commentator who joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us is Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Zafar Bangash, first to you. The last day of the holy month of Ramadan, as I'm sure you are aware, is called International Al-Quds Day, a day that's deemed really important when it comes to the Palestinian cause. And we're looking at the importance that obviously has every year. Some are saying this year's rally is supposed to be very significant. Do you think that is? And what are your thoughts when you think about the significance of Al-Quds Day?
First of all, Al-Quds Day has been declared the last Friday of Ramadan by the late Imam Khomeini as far back as 1980. And today we see that millions of people around the world participate in these rallies. Now this year, it's going to be particularly significant because
Due to the pandemic over the last 2 years in many parts of the world, Quds Day rallies could not be held physically. Although in some parts of the world they were still held, but they were not held, for instance, in North America because of this pandemic restrictions and so on. So many people are looking forward to this year's Quds Day. That's the first point. Secondly, we see that in this Ramadan, again, the Zionists have been violating the sanctity of Masjid al-Aqsa. They've been barging into the holy sanctuary and attacking Palestinians. That obviously has caused a lot of anguish and grief and annoyance among many, many people around the world. And we know that, for instance, with respect to the Zionist policies, they did the same thing last year, which led to an 11-day attack by the Zionists on the Gaza Strip. But this year, of course, again, the Zionists have been attacking the Masjid al-Aqsa. Palestinians have been attacked and shot even inside the masjid. Tear gas shells have been fired. All kinds of other atrocities have been committed. There have been horrific images of worshippers being attacked, their hands and feet being tied. Even women and children are attacked, and scores of people have been killed throughout this month. So obviously, this is a major concern to people that feel for the plight of the Palestinian people, and they want to make sure that they express their concern for what is going on in Palestine, both in terms of the continued illegal occupation of Masjid al-Aqsa, as well as the brutalities that the Zionists are inflicted upon them. So we are expecting massive rallies this year all over the world, particularly in North America and Europe, where incidentally rallies take place not just in one one city or one country, but several cities in each country, which indicates that this issue is now becoming a global issue and people are more and more aware of what the Zionists are doing.
Well, it's interesting, McNapier, I don't know if you agree or not, that we saw how Israel actually chose this year to desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque in the way that it did, in the severity of the way it applied violence. We heard about, for example, for the first time it used drones to, I guess, a spray over the Palestinians, including what happened in Al-Aqsa, which is really sacrilegious in terms of tying, handcuffing people with these Tyvek and shooting rubber bullets at them. Some have said to exploded inside Palestinians, special type of bullets. Anyways, this actually gave a momentum, it appears, to what's going to happen in Al-Quds Day, because there were so many protests that happened prior in just the past few days. Do you think that there will be a bigger momentum this year based on what Israel did at Al-Quds regarding the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
I mean, several things point in that direction. One is the desperation of Palestinians living in a pressure cooker where the Zionist crimes on relatively quiet days continue. But the Israeli state has intensified the repression this Ramadan, and it's not an accident. Last year, as the other speaker, your other guest pointed out, there was a very intense confrontation. But the key thing is that Israel didn't win. They threw families out onto the street in East Jerusalem. There were killings and shootings and beatings across the West Bank. Inside 48 last year, fascist gangs or extreme right-wing gangs, nationalist Jewish gangs, were hunting Palestinians and beating them up for the crime of being Palestinians. And the resistance firing rockets from Gaza somehow brought together the combination of resistance and different types of resistance brought Palestinians together in a very new way. And so when that particular when those 11 days were over, Israel hadn't won, and Israel knew that it hadn't won. It knew that its effort to crush Palestinian resistance had been successful. And therefore, it was clear this Ramadan they would try to win a very decisive victory by intensifying the repression. And the disgusting things that are happening in the Al-Aqsa Mosque are one aspect of intensified repression across the whole of Palestine. Some on the extreme right wing, who usually set the tone for future developments in Israel, have praised Netanyahu for opening up Al-Aqsa Mosque to extremist Jewish settlers, and they are now calling for the restoration of animal sacrifice right throughout the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the threat to the Al-Aqsa Mosque is very real. It's intensified from the Israeli side, also because they feel confident. They have allies in Abu Dhabi, in Morocco, in Egypt, in Oman, in Saudi Arabia, for sure, under the table. And therefore, they think that these alliances give them overwhelming power and that the Palestinians are completely isolated at the level of Arab governments. But they leave aside, they don't take into consideration the power of ordinary people and resistance in all its forms across the Middle East. So I think that the demonstrations this year, I was on a large one in London last Sunday, the demonstrations should be large, should be big, and I think they will be a tribute to Palestinian resistance under incredible pressure in the most, I would argue, the most unequal anti-colonial struggle in history, because the Palestinians face the US, the EU, Britain, etc., and these various Arab states. So the demonstrations are extremely important for one reason, if I can just make one more point. Palestinians are desperate. They are facing an overwhelming military power. But when you see that you're not alone, when you see the power of people coming together around the world in your support, it raises the morale of Palestinians and it damages the morale of the Zionist bloc. And therefore, these demonstrations are very, very important.
In terms of what our guest there, Zafar Bangash, pointed to, and that is how some Arab regimes, if you want to call them, or countries that have formalized their ties with Israel, at least coming out, so to speak, out of the closet on this. Iran's leader has made a statement, and he said just a couple days back, quote, "Unfortunately, Muslim governments are acting very badly vis-a-vis Palestine. They're not even willing to talk about the Palestinian issue, and that some of them imagine that establishing relations with the Zionists is the way to help Palestine. Well, this is a big mistake." Why do you think the Arab leaders went ahead and actually abided by what was a U.S. brokered initiative, knowing that it's going to have a backlash not only against from their own population, but also in terms of the way that they have stabbed the Palestinians in the back?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that these Arab regimes don't have leaders, they have rulers. Leaders are people that are supposed to be elected and supported by their people. In none of these regimes that your other guest mentioned and you mentioned, any of these regimes or the rulers have been elected by the people or given a mandate by the people. So as far as the masses in the Arab world are concerned, they are completely opposed to their regimes. They do not support their policies. There may be one or two areas where perhaps the people are unable to express their anger properly because they are so much oppressed. Like, you can look at the situation in Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates. But in other places, whether it's Egypt or Jordan or Morocco, people are expressing their outrage at the way the Zionists are brutalizing the Palestinian people. Now, with respect to these regimes and the policies that they have adopted, unfortunately, these regimes, as I mentioned, are illegitimate. They don't have the support of their masses. They feel that the United States is gradually pulling out of the region, so they want to secure the other line of defense, and that is to cling to the Zionist regime in the hope that the Zionist regime would perhaps provide them some protection. The Zionist regime itself is not secure. I think we should be very clear about it. Because of the fact that the Palestinian people have not given up, despite all of these decades of Zionist oppression, this in itself is a great victory for the Palestinian people. Secondly, we must keep in mind that 2021, that is last year, when the Zionists launched their barbaric missile attacks on the Gaza Strip, they did not dare invade the Gaza Strip with their ground troops because the Israeli military commanders pointed and told the regime in Tel Aviv that if we carry out a ground invasion, we will not be able to control the situation because the Palestinians have risen up even inside what is referred to as the Green Line. So there was a unity among the Palestinians from last year, and that unity is continuing this year, despite the fact that Palestinians are suffering tremendously in Jerusalem, in Masjid al-Aqsa and Jenin and other parts of West Bank. But the moral high ground is still held by the Palestinian people. And so all of these other activities that these Arabian regimes are indulging in trying to cozy up to the Zionists, will not provide them any security. It is not going to solve the problem of the Palestinian people or the rights of the Palestinian people, because the more these regimes cozy up and align and embrace the Zionist monstrosity, the more anger it would arouse among the people worldwide. I also want to say that, you know, now there are, of course, millions of people in other parts of the world, especially in the Muslim world, whether it's in Iran or Pakistan or Turkey, Malaysia. You can even go into the African countries. You know, there are going to be Quds Day rallies in many, many African countries, including in several cities in South Africa, in Tanzania, in Kenya. So you can see that this is becoming a global phenomenon. And Muslims and non-Muslims all around the world, whether here in Canada, where I'm based, or in the north of, or in the United States, many Christian groups and Jewish groups are joining these Quds Day rallies because they are fed up of the Zionist crimes. The Jewish groups in particular, they are appalled by the atrocities that the Zionists are committing in their name. So they say, not in our name. They do not wish to have anything to do with this these Zionist crimes. So it seems to me that globally, this phenomenon is growing, and this should provide comfort and support and confidence to the Palestinian people to continue their struggle.
Well, Mick Napier, our guest there mentioned something that is really important to bring out here and have your reaction to, and that is the fact that when we look at what happened last Ramadan regarding the violence and the desecration of the mosque, it led to that war, of which we saw two very important things. One, that the rocket range was able to penetrate Israel like never before with their so-called Iron Dome failing. But another very important factor that our guests there talked about is how that within the occupied West Bank in many areas you had infighting between the Arab Palestinians and then the Israelis, which is said to be two reasons why Israel did not wage a war against the Gaza Strip this time around, because it was afraid of those two reasons. Is that a correct analysis or feel on why Israel did not go through with a war on Gaza this time around?
Look, Israel's very cruel, and they have a long-term goal of a Palestine which is free of all Palestinians. But they're very strategic, and they're very alert to how far they can go without causing trouble for their patrons. The Americans and the British will let them go very far, but they'll pull on their chain if they begin to cause real trouble with the populations around the world. And, you know, it's not the side, in an anti-colonial struggle, it's not the side which has the big weapons which wins. You know, the French were massively superior militarily to the Algerian resistance. But it was Algerian people rising in their huge numbers who finally expelled the French colonialists. And I think what your other guest has said is right. It may seem a little bit fanciful sometimes, but it really is popular opinion around the world which can put a constraint on what Israel does. Because, you know, there are 2 billion Muslims in the world, and there are maybe 5 or even 6 million Zionist Jews in Palestine at the moment, and a similar number of Palestinians. So the Israelis always put their finger to the wind. Which way is the wind blowing? How far can They're very brutal. They're genocidal. They're committed to trying to crush Palestinian resistance. The problem is the Palestinians keep resisting. I mean, by any rational measure, they should give up because they're against such overwhelming opposition, but they keep resisting. As long as they keep resisting, Israel feels fragile. You know, it makes me laugh sometimes. A couple of years ago, a few Palestine activists put, I think, 100 posters up on the London Metro overnight. The ambassador was called in. Netanyahu contacted Boris Johnson, I think, or the Prime Minister at the time. They were agitated over a few people putting a few posters up in a London metro system. They feel very fragile. They know what they have done. They know that they're a minority sort of crusader state, an extension of Europe into the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And although they play in the European Cup and they play in various different European games, they know that their future there is not secure. About 40% of Israelis have two passports. And if you measure Israeli opinion, especially among some young people, it's very fragile. They're sure. Not as confident as they try to appear.
Okay.
And Palestinian resistance is the key to the whole thing.
Zafar Bangash, in conclusion, the Iranian proposal has been reiterated many times, and that is the fact that Iran has said, and I'm looking at a variety of officials, even as far back as 4 hours ago, where you had the Iranian president calling for a Palestinian referendum, including for Palestinians who are outside of the land of Palestine. It's a fair proposal. It's logical. What do you think? 30 seconds.
Oh, absolutely. I think if there is going to be a solution short of an absolutely brutal war, then a referendum is the way to go. And I'm absolutely convinced that the Zionists cannot win a military war, not because they don't have the weapons, not because they don't have larger forces, etc., but because the Palestinians refuse to surrender. And so long as the Palestinians refuse to surrender, the Zionists simply cannot win. They cannot wipe out all the Palestinians. So the referendum is the way to go, and that's the only way to ascertain the future of that holy land.
Thank you for that, Zafar Bangash, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Mick Napier, thank you for your input, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitali. It's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
is back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK, and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom. Alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hausa.
Yes.
I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well. And I'm studying in Qom as well, in the Sisters Hausa. And my field of study is Fiqh and Usul. Fiqh and Usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence.
Very great. In today's episode, we're going to have a discussion that circles around the holy month of Ramadan. Now, in some countries, we see that they pass some laws considering drinking or eating in public situations. Personally, what do you think if you were a person who could pass this law? What would have you done? Would you leave it as an optional choice for people to eat or drink in public? Or no, you would say that it must be forbidden. There must be a law that bans eating or drinking in public?
I think that would depend on the ratio of Muslims to non-Muslims in your country, right? So if you have a majority Christian country, it wouldn't be right to implement such a law. Because
so if
Christians
the majority are Muslim, what would you do?
If the majority are Muslims, then possibly yes, because that's a form of nahi anil munkar, which is very important to implement in society.
Would you pass that law? Would you make it ban?
As a law, not particularly, because Muslims each have a responsibility to fast. And if they're not fasting, then they could be an exception to the law. And forcing them to do something that is out of their control, let's say someone is sick, he's on the road, needs to have a medicine right now.
Exactly.
And I come and fine you for drinking water to have your medicine in the middle of the road. While it is out of your control, you need to take that medicine.
Exactly.
Yeah, in those cases, no, I wouldn't pass a law. But every Muslim needs to understand the responsibilities, which is unfortunate that many do not. But as a law, no.
So I think I'm Team Sister Sadiqa, and now you, Brother Muzaffar, well, have to explain to us.
This isn't fair. Sister raised some really good points there. What if they have a medical condition? What if they have, you know, some other issue because of what
you know? In
traveling?
Some countries, they have this law. I think they have some exceptions. There must be exceptions.
Yeah. What if you can implement the law, but then have exceptions too?
Yes.
You know?
Then I would be your team as well.
What about a guy who's just riding a taxi and he's smoking? He's like, does he have a medical condition where he needs to smoke?
Then what should we do in that condition?
In the month of Ramadan. Because, look, fasting in the month of Ramadan is one of the most important faridahs that we have in Islam. Even secular Muslims will engage in fasting in the month of Ramadan.
Yes.
Right? If we fail as a society to implement even that, that's not good.
I saw a documentary in which a Christian person said that in our country, eating and drinking during the holy month is free. You can do whatever you like. But since we have a respect for Muslim people, we don't do that.
And this is another factor as well. Let's say you have an exception, right? You have a medical condition.
Yes.
Why are you standing in the street and eating a turkey sandwich when everybody else is fasting? There's kids who are fasting.
Which is
they're going to see you.
Very,
it's
very
gonna affect
bad situation.
You really badly.
Exactly. Especially because we have some kids who are starting to fast.
Yeah.
You know?
Actually,
they're very young and they have to start.
Yeah, I mean, that's not fair. Look, you're trying to train your 10-year-old kid to fast. Or your 13-year-old. And they're looking at it. Look at that man. He's just scoffing a...
Exactly. A bulky person
he's eating
is eating
a
that
trifle,
burger and then
pudding.
That kid is looking at them.
Okay, there's another thing. When it comes to implementing laws, generally speaking, throughout the Islamic Republic and in the future, inshallah, when we establish more Islamic republics in the world, generally speaking, there are laws for public spheres and for private spheres. As far as I know, even in the Islamic Republic of Iran, right, things like alcohol are banned in the public sphere, right? You want loud music and parties, for example, it's banned in the public sphere and you have the right to do Nahi Anil Munkar as a citizen. to those people. But if people are doing that secretly in their basements,
in their houses, yes,
do it, because that is, you know, it's still wrong.
It is not our business, it's your business.
Yeah, you go ahead and do that.
Yes, exactly.
The problem with secular, predominantly Western societies, mm-hmm. is that those same gunas, those same haram acts, are taking place and being endorsed publicly. That's really what Islam has an issue with.
So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
There was a companion of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, mm-hmm. and he broke into somebody's house to catch them drinking alcohol in their house.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "You shouldn't be drinking alcohol." And the guy pointed the finger back and he said, "All right, I'm drinking alcohol, but you've just broken more rules of Islam."
Exactly.
First of all, Islam says that you should enter through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
You entered through the back.
Exactly.
Secondly, you entered without my permission.
We got the point.
The idea is this, that mm-hmm. publicly these sins should not be done. And I think if we have the power to implement laws which will prevent that thing from taking place in
exactly.
the public, we should, shouldn't we?
You know, that all comes with what sister said. Every single person in this society is responsible. If I consider that as my duty to do whatever I have to do, truly, then there would be no problem. And as you said, the problem is with doing those things in public.
Mm.
Now, if you want to do that at your home or any place that is going to be secret, it's no problem. It's not at least our problem.
Yeah.
But when you do it in public, then it turns to be a problem. Now, sister, I would ask you a question. How should we react against these people?
You see, first, when it comes down to the public sphere, we need to understand that this is a personal point, right? I'm not going to base it on religious rulings. It's a very personal point. That the more we impose on societies these sort of
laws
in the general society, we get people who are very rebellious.
Exactly.
What we need to start off is with educating the people about different laws.
And it will cause some tensions, unnecessary tensions.
Unnecessary tensions. As well, if a person is educated about a specific law, why it has come in place, why Islam discourages people from eating in public in the month of Ramadan, educating would have much more of a better effect.
But do you think that would do some good, educating?
Yes, because the intellect is more powerful than our shahwa. It's more powerful than our desire.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people eat in a public environment because they do not understand the importance of the month of Ramadan. They did not understand the importance of fasting.
Mm-hmm.
They did not understand the importance of allowing others to fast.
Or if they know, they just have a problem and they are
that is against the others.
Yes, the rebellious people.
That comes from their rebellious nature. And if they do it just to spite people, unfortunately, we can't really do much about that.
Yes, exactly.
But not everyone's out there to spite others.
Mm-hmm.
People just do not understand. They just want to go with the flow, with the status quo. If we understand where they are coming from, if we start educating our communities from a very young age, not when they're 50, 60 years old,
mm-hmm.
educate them from a very young age,
very young.
We can progress in how religious rulings are seen in a much more positive light, rather than I'm going to fine you or I'm going to get you into jail because you just had a turkey sandwich in the street.
Mm-hmm. So now we educated them. We did all we could do to nurture them in order to be responsible and show that responsibility in public. But still, we see some people who do that. How would you react against them when you see them?